From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tighe. Today on the program, the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service takes a unique approach to covering poverty on the city's north side. Plus, a journalist uses the online news source as material for his graduate thesis on journalism and community building.
While there's nothing dramatic about it, there is evidence that what's being reported on NNS is being carried over from neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood.
And the hero of Joshua Ferris's novel is a dentist who can't get out of his own head, thanks to his patients.
One guy's got cancer, one guy won't floss, the other guy has a cavity that he won't take care of. So these people continually keep him on notice that the march of time is working always.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Most of the news stories we read or see that relate to poverty get to the issue through some other lens: crime, unemployment, housing issues. But writer Brendan O'Brien set out to cover poverty differently in an ongoing series of reports for the online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. O'Brien's series focuses on poverty as a way of life in the neighborhoods on Milwaukee's north side. And he joins us in the Lake Effect studio to share some of the backstory. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Poverty in Milwaukee seems like an enormous undertaking for a series. How did you conceive of it, and how did you set out to make it manageable?
We conceived of it a couple months ago when we realized that it's the 50th anniversary of LBJ waging war on poverty. And my intention, my goal has always been to, as a reporter, to get away from what decisions are being made in Washington and Madison and get down to the narrative of how people make decisions, how consumers make decisions, how people operate and run their lives.
Did you find there was a story about poverty that just wasn't being told?
Yes. And that story is around the poor's balance sheets, in terms of on one side they have income and entitlements, and on the other side they have bills like the rest of us. They have mortgages and rents and utilities. And the story that wasn't being told is how they make ends meet, how they find a way to make the extra $100 for their very tight balance sheets to work every month.
Did you find that one part of the series led to another? Did you have all of these mapped out in advance?
No, I did not have all these mapped out. I still don't. What's extraordinary about the series is I'm working in this area between Wisconsin and Capitol and Highway 43 and 60th on the west. And so I go in this area every couple days and find stories. And what's amazing to me is the richness and the depth of the stories that I find. So, for instance, I was doing a story about SNAP and food stamp benefits, and I realized that there's more to the story in terms of where people get their food and how they shop for produce and food. And so I started going into convenience stores, and that led to an entire story about convenience stores and what they mean to the community and what they're all about.
And that was really one of the remarkable parts of this series that really struck me. I mean, convenience stores or corner grocery stores have gotten a lot of criticism from kind of outside of these neighborhoods. People say that they don't have enough fresh produce. But you write that the people who live in these neighborhoods are really pretty appreciative of the role that they serve.
Yes, they are. They rely on these grocery stores, not just in these convenience stores, not just for their food and the gallon of milk here and the toilet paper there. What they rely on is these grocery stores, these convenience stores are part of their neighborhoods, part of their blocks. And so some of these owners give out IOUs, and one store owner I spoke with even donates money and items to funerals for people who have been killed by the violence in the neighborhoods. I found it extraordinary that there is this. They're part of the fabric. They're also a social part of the fabric of these communities or these neighborhoods, in terms of they act as a gathering place. People mingle in these stores. They watch basketball games. They talk about politics. They talk about what's happening on the street. It's really a fascinating look. I went into about 30 of them. And every one I went into, there was a different story and a different vibe to them.
Well, and one of the things that really struck me was at least one of the owners was saying, you know, on one hand, he has a problem with kids who come in to shoplift and steal things. And on the other hand, he doesn't have any problem giving IOUs or donating food items and other things to people who really can't afford something, say, at the end of the month.
It's the nature of their business. They're business owners, they're small business owners, and they really believe in what they're doing, and they believe in the long-term benefits for both them and their communities. So it is the cost of doing business. Shoplifting is just a nature of being a convenience store owner. On the other hand, you have to give back because you have to build trust, especially with the poor.
Another, I guess, similar story you did was about the phenomenon of street mechanics.
Yeah.
These are people who are serving the same role as mechanics in other parts of town in other ways, but in a real distinctive sort of way.
That story, again, was a derivative of just driving around the neighborhoods and seeing what was going on in the neighborhoods, getting out of my car and talking to people. And what I realized was I would drive around, and especially on hot days, warm days in the spring, there would be a lot of cars that would have their hoods up and people in their heads inside the cars fixing them. And so I wanted to find out a little bit about that. And what I realized, it was the poor rely on the poor. They rely on their family members. They rely on the people that live in their neighborhood, their neighbors. And it's a sort of a hidden economy that goes on. When a car breaks down, you don't call a tow truck. You call your best friend's brother who knows how to fix cars. And there's also a trust that goes on here too. They trust – when you're poor, you tend to trust those that are around you more often than, let's say, someone you've never met that is 20 miles away or 5 miles away, who you now have to deal with to get your car, a vital part of your life, fixed on time to get to work the next day. So there is this trust thing that goes on, and I find that the poor tend to trust those people that are closest to them, both in family and both geographically.
And these mechanics, they're basically just charging for labor. They tell the people what kind of part they need. They wait for them to come out of the auto parts store, and they're charging less for labor than you'd find at, a more traditional garage.
Yeah, in some cases they would charge less, but there's a value to what they're charging too. You don't get the guarantees. You don't get the warranties with them, but you do get a handshake. You do get a – they're not wearing a Midas or a Meineke shirt. They're the regular Joe Schmoes. And again, they're friends and they're family members. So you get this – in a way, you get a different type of trust.
Both that story and the one about convenience stores and many of the other parts of this series, actually, what really I think struck me was that they're not about how people aren't getting by. They are about how people are scraping by, if only just barely.
Yeah, and the interesting thing for me about the series, the most surprising thing about the series is that poverty tends to be thought of as a statistic. And when I started driving through these neighborhoods and on these blocks, what I realized is poverty has a smell, a feel, a vibe to it, a language to it. There's a culture. It's built on community. It's built on trust, built on faith. And it's amazing how much, for a journalist, it's amazing how much richness there is there just by driving around and talking to people, chatting with people, having discussions about their lives.
It sounds like there's a lot more resilience there than people might be normally giving the poor credit for.
There's a lot more resilience. There's a lot more hope. They're ingenious about how they go about their lives. I also find this entire conversation and narrative about the poor being lazy is downright false. It's hard work to be poor. It is poverty takes a physical, emotional, mental toll. And to get up every day and figure out how you're going to put food on the table for your children without a regular steady paycheck, and they still get it done, is amazing to me.
Where do you go next?
Continue to go into the streets of Milwaukee and find the stories about Milwaukeeans' way of life and how they deal. And the next story that I think I'll tackle is there is a habit, a part of the hidden economy of landscaping. And there's people out there that knock on doors and mow lawns for a living. They knock on doors of their neighbors and they go out there and mow their lawns for $20 a lawn. And that's how they make their living. And so that's the next probably story that I'll do.
Brendan O'Brien, thanks so much. We'll be reading.
Thanks.
Brendan O'Brien is a reporter with the online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. You'll find a link to his series on poverty in Milwaukee from WUWM.com/lake effect. The Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service itself is the subject of an academic analysis by journalist Herbert Lowe. We'll find out what his study revealed about the news service's place in the modern journalism universe when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues. I'm Mitch Tyke. Before the break, we spoke with reporter Brendan O'Brien about his series on poverty in Milwaukee, written for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. The online media source has been operating for 3 years with support from places such as the Zilber Neighborhood Initiative, United Neighborhood Centers of Milwaukee, and Marquette University. Among the outlet's missions has been to cover hyper-local neighborhood stories that are often missed by larger publications with broader scopes. But has that ambition been realized? And how does the Neighborhood News Service itself figure into the work of community building? Herbert Lowe is the professional in residence and director of journalism for social change at Marquette University's Diedrich College of Communication. The news service was the topic of his recently completed master's thesis. And he's with us in the studio along with journalism professor John Pauley and NNS editor-in-chief Sharon McGowan. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What led you to study the Neighborhood News Service in an academic way in the first place?
I was pursuing my master's degree, and a thesis was one of the options. I actually was going to do a professional project on another topic, and a wise man suggested that I do something more intellectually robust. And when I asked him if he had any ideas, the very next thought was, you should do a case study of the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. And that struck me as really odd because I didn't know a thesis could be directly across the hall from me because the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service was directly across from my office. And I had been engaged with its staff and particularly Sharon McGowan as a journalism faculty member and who has had 22 years of journalism experience. And so clearly as a member of its editorial advisory board, an advocate for it and the students engaged with it and what it's trying to do in the community. And then when someone who you respect and is the most intellectual man tells you that this is something you should do, you have to do it. So,
John Pauley, what was it about the Neighborhood News Service that you thought lent itself to such an academically and intellectually rigorous approach?
I thought there were two things. One is that there's a long history of discussion in journalism about the relationship between journalism and community. And so we had a really lively experiment right on our doorstep. And the second is, even for all of the struggles in the journalism profession, now this is a moment of tremendous energy within the profession and experimentation. And I thought that this would be a good case study to pursue to see what's happening in Milwaukee in relationship to larger national trends.
Well, why me?
You were the right man for the job. Well, you have a passion for the community side and some personal history and professional history with that. So I thought that you were well positioned to do it.
And so in a nutshell, what was the question you were trying to answer with this work in terms of the nexus of the Neighborhood News Service and community?
Well, what was it that they intended to do? What was it that people – how were people responding to it? What were the people who were engaged with it learning about it? And what exactly was the work that was being done?
Sharon McGowan, how would you describe the community mission of the Neighborhood News Service?
Well, I think that the most important thing is that we're professional, objective journalists covering the communities. But I have been persuaded, and I'm beginning to understand, that the notion of more community engagement is apparently the future. And the more I think about it, the more excited I am about it, because I think that we are doing a good job in a traditional sense, but there's no reason why we can't push the envelope and be a little more experimental.
Herbert Lowe, how do you measure the creation of community, if you will?
Well, geography, political aspirations, basically who lives near you or is trying to have the same matters of quality of life that you are and the energies that are around them. For communities such as NNS focuses on.
This is like 17 neighborhoods.
Yes, 17 neighborhoods in the central city of Milwaukee. It's about being able to improve the qualities of life that everyone should have in terms of public safety, education, being able to walk and on your streets and feeling safe. It is not any different from those who are in communities in the suburbs. The work that the NNS is doing relates to being able to show that there are people fully engaged in improving the quality of life and that it is worth investing in if you have resources or money to do so.
Chair McGowan.
Yes, I just wanted – I think Herb did a really good job describing community. The way that I heard your question, though, is how can you measure – whether what we're doing has any effect on community. And I think that that's the big research question that would need to be answered. I don't think anybody knows how to do that exactly. And if there were some kind of standard by which we could measure ourselves.
If there were an algorithm that allowed you to connect the dots that says because of this reporting, this has been the impact on the quality of life in this neighborhood, that would be great.
Right. I think that it's a very good question and one that we think about a lot, but I don't think we figured out how to do it.
Right. But as Sharon, you said in your interview with me and as we researched for the thesis, there are many organizations in these 17 neighborhoods that see work or stories on NNS that they then can go and either relink to their sites. Here's a good idea that's working in this neighborhood. Maybe we could try it in ours. And so while there's nothing dramatic about it, but there is evidence that what's being reported on NNS is being carried over from neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood.
John Pauley, this is kind of an eternal question that journalists have had. Does my work have an impact?
Yeah, and I think there are different places where you can look for the impact. And so I think in the initial question, it's harder to prove citizen by citizen in the neighborhoods what the impact is. But I think the last point Herb was making was really crucial, that the impact has been on the leaders within these communities, that there are people of vision and passion and ability in smaller scale organizations that don't necessarily – aren't entirely visible within larger mainstream media. And the Neighborhood News Service has given them a chance to make their another opportunity for leadership and then connecting across those groups. And so it is building the network of leadership, I think, at that point. And there's still more to be said and thought about in terms of the effect on individual citizens within.
Part of what we looked at was the sources for the stories that NNS covered. Many scholars have said that journalists often will go to what comes out of City Hall or officials' sources and go straight to someone's doorstep and see what you think about it. There's also the notion of conflict and tension that drives the news. And what the Neighborhood News Service is doing is writing stories that show that leaders can happen right from people who have no education at all or who simply just want to keep, as one of the mothers that Dunn did that, I believe it is the story, they simply just want to keep their kids from being target practice for people with guns. And so the quasi-official neighborhood groups where they get most of their stories from private public places. These are places that NNS is getting to that the Journal Sentinel, maybe Lake Effect or other Milwaukee magazine, they simply don't have the resources to go into these places. And so these are stories that need to be told but otherwise aren't getting told. And what NNS is doing differently than if we touch on community journalism, NNS is doing it at a quality of presentation and reporting that you don't see in an organization of this size.
Sharon McGowan, how do you build the community building issue into the kinds of training that your journalists are getting?
I don't think I focus on that. What I focus on is teaching them, if they don't already know, how to find a source, report a story, write a story, do a video or audio slideshow about a story, and then make sure that the quality is high enough to publish. That said, I don't ever bring on an intern who I think is not interested really in covering the communities that we cover. There's a lot of people who want this on their resume, but if they don't show some interest in what we do, then it's not a good fit.
John Pauley, is this representative of a bigger emphasis in community involvement among journalists who are coming up through the ranks today?
I think it's really important for journalists to be self-reflective about their mode of address to the community. And I think we take that for granted. We know what those routines and habits look like traditionally in journalism in relationship to the people that Herb was describing as official sources. So one of the things that's important in this kind of journalism is putting yourself in the neighborhood and having a respect for that, being willing to listen to a different kind of voice, being willing to hear the stories that matter to people. And I think that's something that journalism, just as a, in general as an institution right now, is trying to think through in all of its forms. So what does it mean to have journalism matter to the community for these people? What would it take for us to do that kind of work that would make it matter deeply to them?
Well, and I wonder if some of this is what sets apart organizations like the Neighborhood News Service and to some degree local newspapers in general from the national news services that everybody is on all the time on their computers and their smartphones and wherever else they get their news.
Yeah, I think that it's very important to understand that our reporters, whether they're the professional reporters, we have right now three professional reporters, they are not youngsters, they're all experienced, and they are the core of our reporting staff. They and the interns have to be in the neighborhoods in order to do this reporting. You cannot do this reporting on the phone, although sometimes they try, but it's clearly obvious. You have to be there. You have to talk to people. And you should be bringing back another story because every time you talk to somebody or a group of people, you should be finding another story. And that holds for everybody from the most experienced reporter to the newest intern.
Herbert Lowe, let's flash forward through all of this work that you did. What's the overarching takeaway message that you want to get out there and hope that your research gets out into the community that the Neighborhood News Service is covering?
Across this nation, the industry that we know as journalism is changing, and there are more stories to tell but fewer people in position to tell them. And as legacy news organizations have to rethink what stories they're going to be able to tell and how they're going to be able to tell them, if communities and journalism education programs are able to come together through grant funding or other means, that it is possible to tell great stories and dynamically presented about matters involving quality of life in neighborhoods such as the kinds that Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service is doing, and that it can be done excellently, and that stories matter and how they're told matter and who tells them matter. One thing that we haven't said here is that most of the professional staff that Sharon engages with are from the communities. Edgar Mendez, for example, grew up on the South Side, went to UWM, earned his journalism degree, was desperate to get into journalism in the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service in Marquette, enabled him to get the experience he needed to now earn an internship this summer at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and he will have a master's degree while at it. And so these are opportunities that can be replicated in communities such as ours across the nation. And if people want to see what is happening here, they can read this. We've had some other consultants look at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service and advise Sharon and the Editorial Advisory Board and the College of Communication on how to be of the community, not just report about the community, and just figuring out how to do the great journalism objectively and professionally as Sharon demands, but also increase the audience, increase not just within the community but externally as well.
How does this work play into the question of the news service's sustainability? It was created through some initial grants, which are coming to the end of their cycle.
They are coming to the end of their cycle. We expect most of them to be renewed. We sold our first ad this week, which I think it's going to bring in about $20, but it's a start.
A throwback to high school journalism.
Right. So we are focusing very much on sustainability. We're in the process of figuring out how to hire somebody whose sole responsibility will be the business side, marketing, and fundraising, which is not my expertise and it's not what I want to do. So I'm excited about that.
I would make the case that NNS needs more personality, that it needs to have faces, much like Gregory Stanford or Eugene Cain or James Causey, notable columnists of color, black columnists for the Journal Sentinel, have created a presence in the community, in the communities that the Journal Sentinel serves. I maintain that the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service needs people. We, in this day and age, for better or for worse, news agencies are identified by personalities, whether it's cable, talk shows, or legacy news organizations. And so that is important. The second concern that must be noted that is that Sharon McGowan is shouldering an incredible amount of responsibility regarding editing and marketing, and she's basically the life of NNS. And I'd love to be able to see her get some editorial support. I'd love to see her be able to take a vacation. I'd just love to be able to know that if Sharon McGowan was to win the lottery and didn't want to work this hard anymore, that there would be someone else who can make sure that this great work continues.
I will second that opinion. Herbert Lowe, Sharon McGowan, John Pauley, thank you all so much.
Thanks,
thank
Mitch.
You.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
Sharon McGowan is editor-in-chief of the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. John Pauley is professor of journalism at Marquette University's Diedrich College of Communication. And Herbert Lowe is professional-in-residence at the college. His recently completed master's thesis is on the Neighborhood News Service. In the interest of full disclosure, I was among the people interviewed for that thesis. Dentistry, existentialism, and baseball, all woven together seamlessly in a new novel. We'll find out more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. There are a lot of human inventions like philosophy and religion that attempt to answer the big questions. Why are we here? Do we have a purpose? Why are we so unhappy so much of the time? Do we have the capacity to change? And what does it mean to be a Boston Red Sox fan when they actually win the World Series? Writer Joshua Ferris manages to take on all of these questions in his new novel, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. His protagonist, Paul, agonizes over all of these existential issues as he cares for the mouths of his Park Avenue dentistry patients. Ferris was in Milwaukee recently. He spoke with Bonnie North, but first shared an excerpt from the book.
My favorite children's book is called Dr. DeSoto by William Stieg. Dr. DeSoto is a mouse dentist who will fix the mouth of any animal who doesn't eat mice. It says so right on the sign hanging outside his shop. Cats and other dangerous animals not accepted for treatment. It's a reasonable policy. It has led me to wonder if I've ever done any work on the mouth of a murderer. One day, a fox shows up outside Dr. DeSoto's office, weeping with pain. Hippocratically bound and inherently kind, Dr. DeSoto is predisposed to help the fox and his wife, who works as his assistant, encourages him to take pity on the poor beast. So Dr. DeSoto, the brave hero dentist, climbs into the fox's mouth and finds a rotten bicuspid in unusually bad breath. This is how you know that Stieg wasn't a dentist. It's all unusually bad. The fox is grateful to Dr. DeSoto. Yet even knowing that his redeemer is in his mouth at that very moment, working to remedy the pain, the fox itches to eat that tasty little morsel. Dr. DeSoto puts the fox under to extract the tooth, and the fox, laying bare his irrepressible nature, drunkenly mutters how he best likes his mice prepared. That night, Dr. DeSoto has his misgivings about the next day's follow-up. A fox is a fox is a fox. However, he must go through with it. Once he starts a job, he always finishes it. His father, he says, was the same way. My father, too. He'd start to redo the bathroom grout or lay new linoleum in the kitchen with any other man's new project gusto. And when it was exactly one-third complete, he'd leave, drive some distance, sell the car for a low figure, and walk home and hand the money to my mother, weeping. I won't spoil the ending for you, but needless to say, a fox is a fox is a fox. The foremost heroism on display in Dr. DeSoto isn't the mouse's noble determination to help despite the mortal dangers all around, but the touching suggestion, briefly entertained, that the fox might have an innate capacity to change. When I was filling a cavity or doing a root canal or extracting a tooth that was beyond repair, I'd think, this could have been prevented. I'd fall back on my old cynical view of human nature. They don't brush, they don't floss, they don't care. A fox is a fox is a fox. But when they did brush and floss and still lost a tooth, I had to blame something else. And just as predictably, I'd point the finger at cruel nature or an indifferent God. I was always saying bad oral health was entirely in their control, unless I was saying that it was entirely out of their control. Then one day, I had a patient come in, lived around the corner in one of the few remaining low-income housing complexes on the Upper East Side, worked construction, his hands the hands of a blind strangler, no effort beforehand to remove the chewing tobacco encreviced between his teeth. And while I was at work on a little local train wreck in the upper left quadrant, I let my mind wander. This guy probably had poor genes, ignorant parents, a mean childhood. He was never going to take care of his teeth. He never stood a chance of taking care of them. He was going to neglect them until they fell out or he died. Unless by some miracle, he got up from the chair and changed his life. Unless some store of character revealed itself, and with a little guidance from me, he returned in 6 months a new man. But even then, I thought, that change, that character, would have to be in him already. I was never going to manufacture it with a few stern warnings. God knows I'd tried. And pain forgets within the hour what it learns in an instant. The man in the chair was lord over his best impulses no more than he was king of his worst instincts. Change or no change, his fate was out of his hands. The only question that ever remained was, are you a fox or something better?
Joshua Ferris, welcome to Lake Effect. That was lovely.
Thanks, Bonnie. Thanks for having me.
To Rise Again at a Decent Hour, your latest book, which we just heard that wonderful excerpt from, I almost don't know where to start because there are so many things going on here. But I guess that sort of existential angst moves through the entire thing. And Paul, your protagonist, is trying to figure out who he is and if he has the capacity to change.
Yeah, essentially. He's so at odds with the world. He's very unhappy in many respects. He's a well-paid dentist, so he has a job to go to. He has a nice apartment in Brooklyn. He should, by all measures, be a content man, but he's not. And I think that that really goes to the heart of existence. Why is he here? Why do people suffer? How should he spend his time? What kind of meaningful connections will he make with other people while he's here? All of these questions just aggrieve him, and he's trying to find the answer. And it's really not until he discovers he may belong to a little-known religion that he's willing to consider some other alternatives.
It's not only that they aggrieve him, it's that he can't not stop thinking about them. he is possessed by this. I mean, a lot of people think about this stuff, but it doesn't completely shape their days.
Yeah, he's his worst enemy for sure. And I think in part that's because as a dentist, He has people continually coming into the office who are beset by mortal problems. One guy's got cancer. One guy won't floss. The other guy has a cavity that he won't take care of. So these people continually keep him on notice that the march of time is working always. And then there's the fact that he's just sort of ignored, neglected. I think he describes himself at one point as, at best, a colossal inconvenience for people. So he can't really relax his mind from these thoughts.
So why a dentist, looking at that mortal coil unraveling as opposed to, say, a doctor?
Well, because they're so ignored, you know? They have a rich store of wisdom to impart to each patient, but the patient comes in, gets done, and just flees, you know? And I know this as well just by virtue of being a patient, you know? Flossing's no fun. You don't want to have to do it every day. You don't want to have to go in and get your cavity filled or take care of a root canal. So I think this aggrievement that I think defines him has so much to do with the way in which a dentist isn't respected as well as a doctor is. So I think I would have taken that edge off him if I had made him a, you know, neurologist or something.
And also, I think dentists are feared in a way that maybe your average GP isn't.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you go in to a doctor, you may be really sick, but they're not going to take a really small metal thing out and start poking you with it, you know, in the most delicate places. I mean, it's just, you know, between the gum and the tooth, you just don't want a metal piece there. And boy, they just know how to do it.
Yeah, there's something about that, I think, that also feeds in. It's like his choice of profession has made sure that he has that distance. Even though he wants the connection with other people so badly, he's almost set himself up to make sure that that distance remains because of the very profession that he has.
Yeah. Well, he's got to create that or he's going to go crazy. He's going to basically kidnap some people and just floss them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, going postal or going dental.
Going dental.
The other part of this, or one of the other parts of this, is that little known religion that he finds out that he's a part of, that he resists, but he ends up helping him figure out in some ways who he is.
Yeah, he's such an avowed atheist, this guy. And it seems to me that can become its own dogma. And I think that for the bulk of his life, he describes himself as being so resolute in that opinion. And yet the world is not offering him the kind of solace that he might find being a part of a community that all of a sudden presents itself as a possibility. Does he or does he not belong to this heavily persecuted and little-known religion? And not only does he belong or not belong, does it exist? What makes a religion exist? What differentiates a religion from a cult? These questions start to swirl around him and get him thinking in different directions that I think ultimately does reveal that he's something more than a fox.
It also ties in to his resistance to the modern world of technology as well, because that all feeds into it, because this all begins with a webpage that purports to be by him but isn't.
Right. He sort of comes out of the office, comes out of one of the workstations to discover that there's been a website created in his name on behalf of the dental practice, and nobody has made it in the office. So this really sets him off, and it sets the book in motion in terms of he's got to find out who's done this to him and why. And in the course of that exploration, you also come to learn that he really just wants to belong in ways that he's never really allowed himself or that he doesn't feel legitimate. He wants to belong at first to a family of Catholics, and then he wants to belong to a family of Jews. And he doesn't feel, because he hasn't been born into these traditions, that he belongs there. So when the possibility that he may belong to the Catholics of the Catholics and the Jews of the Jews, he's very intrigued.
Well, he also belongs to another interesting community, and that is of the Red Sox fan.
That's right.
And that permeates the book as well. And having grown up in that Red Sox culture myself, I recognized it instantly. And that shifted for him in 2004 when they won the World Series after 86 years.
Yeah. He has an identity crisis.
He sure does. Yeah. It's a big one.
Well, I wondered if there, if it was a very prevalent condition among in Red Sox Nation. You know, I mean, for so many years, the passion and the heartbreak defined the Red Sox in ways that, say, with the Cubs, it didn't, because the Cubs were just sort of expected to lose. The Red Sox were truly expected to win. And in the 86 years that they did not, came very close to doing so. So when they did finally win and won in such a spectacular fashion, I wondered if about a year later there were some avid fans who wondered, well, who are we now? What makes us unique in the world of baseball? And will we just come to replicate our most reviled enemy?
And we know who that is. Well, maybe listeners here don't know who that is, but of course, that's the New York Yankees. I loved the juxtaposition of baseball with this and the Red Sox with this small, you know, as you say, the Jew of the Jew, the Catholic of the Catholic religion, if it exists at all, you know, and somehow needing to find yourself part of something that matters, that other, you know, that you can, that you can hang your hat on and say, well, this is, this defines me.
Yeah.
And this is who I am.
You know, I'm just a white guy. I'm some white dude who was sort of had like promiscuous Christianity over the course of his life. I went to different denominations and we would just sort of drift in and out of different churches. And so I never really felt like I had a core identity. And when I was going to school, when I went to college, you know, multiculturalism was very much on everyone's minds. And so the little subcultures that I looked into as an outsider were far richer than my experiences, both at home and sort of within the larger community. So the kind of the historic irony for me is that I could be accepted anywhere. You know, nobody would turn me away for this or that because I was the white dude. But even though I had access to everywhere, I didn't really belong anywhere. And so when I looked into tight-knit religious groups, in particular a friend of mine at, who I roomed with at Iowa, I went to the University of Iowa, and my roomie there was a Jewish guy from the northern suburbs of Chicago, northwest suburbs of Chicago. And I just got inaugurated into Judaism in a way that was really interesting to me. And I sort of longed for those kind of traditions and the rituals and the just the community that it provided. And so I, you know, that's sort of Paul's perspective, the dentist's perspective, is to look from the outside in and see all that he's missing. And he really, really wants some of it.
But at the same time, he wants it, but he rejects it. He doesn't want to be defined by someone else.
Right.
He wants to define himself.
Right. And here's the rub, I think, in particular with respect to God, because he can't believe. He's too rational. He's too sort of fixed on the reasoned debate and can't allow himself to think of the possibility. And that really does restrict one's participation in a community that centers itself around God. So I think he's trying to figure out how he might participate, and they kind of fail him. But this particular religion embraces skepticism. And so not only does it dovetail nicely with his need for community, but it also seems to have some theological underpinnings that he might get on board with.
Yes, and his adventures into it are really quite that. They're quite interesting, and he travels to Israel, which is where would you say the headquarters are? Is there a headquarters?
Yeah, it's kind of like a headquarters.
Yeah, a
kind of discreet headquarters.
Right.
Out in the desert.
Yeah.
With some goats hanging around.
Exactly. We have to have goats.
It's a low rent headquarters.
Do you think he finds himself? Do you think he finds that belonging?
I think that the more interesting question might be, does he allow himself the possibility of it? When it's foreclosed to you for so long because of a principle or a strong opinion, just getting to the point where you ask yourself if that is all that helpful to you in your life is a big change. And I think he does. I think he asks himself eventually, do I really want to live shrouded in my skepticism, or do I want to allow for the possibility of something that might surprise me? And he gets surprised.
So he does open himself up to the possibility, but he also hangs on to some of himself from before too.
Yeah, well, let's not kid ourselves. Yeah. When people change, they still retain a whole heck of a lot of their old baggage. So, you know, I think it would have been dishonest of me to present in the closing pages of the book an entirely new person, somebody that wasn't aggrieved by the challenges of being alive. So he retains enough to be irascibly lovable, but he's the same guy, but he's thinking about other ways to live. And I think that that does dawn on us from time to time. I'm kind of a skeptic about the amount to which we can change, to the amount to which we can really get outside of ourselves and live an entirely new way. And so I think I try to do as good a job as possible, as good a to allow him to change as much as I think it's humanly possible to change, and see what kind of contentedness might fall over him in the closing bits of the book.
Well, Joshua, it has been such a pleasure, and thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Joshua Ferris's latest novel is called To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. It's just out in hardcover. He spoke with Bonnie North when he was here for a reading at Boswell Book Company. One last break, and then a Lake Effect essayist looks back on a source of school-aged angst, one that might not have been the same issue for you. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. The school cafeteria can be a chaotic place. Kids ripping open their lunch bags and boxes, trying to check out what the kid next to them got, and sometimes trying to swing a trade. Lake Effect essayist Alexandra Rosas still remembers those days as a time of great stress in her school day.
I am a suburban mother of three school-aged children, which means that, like most parents across America, I pack my children's school lunches Monday through Friday, with 3 months off at summer. But that's where the similarity with my American counterparts ends. I am a first-generation American. My family comes from South America. For most mothers out there, the pleasant memories of trading lunches with grade school friends brings a smile to their lips as they seal baggies with fun and whimsical lunch fare for their American children. You probably remember yourselves, back in second grade, sitting at the long lunchroom table across from your friends, chattering away while pulling out the contents of what your very American parent has packed for you. Such sweet memories you have, reminiscing about swapping lunches. You have a smile on your face, don't you? Meanwhile, my lunchroom memories conjure up a knot in my stomach. It all has to do with what your childhood lunches were like. My first generation, born here lunches, can only be described with one word: panic. All in intentional caps. My lunchtimes were a daily, relentless dose of watching the American children around me gleefully dig into their bags and pull out the amazing TV commercial contents from their lunchboxes. Little Debbie snack cakes, shiny bags of potato chips, perfect factory-made fruit pies. My South American lunches were so different from the ones I saw around me. The anxiety and angst-ridden grade school lunch trade, when the contents of my lunch shouted out to the world who and what and where I came from. Oh, to be part of the consumer crowd, to be one with the deli ham and processed cheese sandwiches, the Hostess snowballs, the Sunny D delights. Hey, I'd cry hopefully, who wants to trade me their tuna salad sandwich on whole grain for a big fat slice of musky goat cheese and guava jelly? Look, my abuela threw in a chunk of mango on top for extra Latino measure. You could hear the squeals of ooh as the American children watched me carefully Jenga stack a cube of cheese on top of a cube of guava on top of a cube of mango. Mm-mm-mm, that's good eating right there. What are you eating, they'd ask, not really wanting to know. Mmm, this here? Oh, why, this is a delicious guava jelly and goat cheese breadless sandwich. Yum! I trade with you, but I just want it all for myself. Or so went my fantasy script. This mental dialogue was my attempt to make them feel envy. I'd sit at my school desk, eyes on the clock. At just a few minutes before noon, I'd prepare myself for the presentation of the lunch that was just too good to trade with anybody. Yes, I was convinced that I could convince them. I knew the lunches my Colombian abuela would have packed for me would be red hot up on that ethnicity scale. So many possibilities. Would she have thrown in a peel dice platano? Maybe a papaya? Could I be lucky enough for a thermos full of the Colombian signature dish calentado? I would grow woozy from the combination of late morning hunger and forgetting to breathe as my heart pounded over what was in my clearance shelf white monkey's lunchbox, my mother's loving attempt at a lunchbox that she thought would help me fit in. How could I have explained to her that there's a reason things are in the clearance rack? It was easier to just use the darn thing. As the minutes ticked closer and closer to the big noontime reveal of the contents of my monkey's lunchbox, my plan was always the same. I would sit down, lay out a spot, and present my lunch as a thing of beauty. Everyone at the table would know that their palates weren't sophisticated enough to trade their lunch for mine. That was my daydream anyway. I wanted to be part of the fun, to be in on the food trading, to hear other children go, ooh, and lick their lips over what my lunchbox had inside. But this was the late 1960s, and cultural diversity was not a happening thing, especially not in a parochial school in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. This story is from a long time ago, but I still remember it as I pack my children's lunches today. I tell my three boys of my Colombian grandmother's slices of white goat cheese with a generous slab of guava jelly atop, garnished with tropical fruit. They ask me if that's why I'm so weird. I answer them, yes, it probably is. I can't be 100% positive, but probably. I then remind my children that I am living proof that that which doesn't kill us just makes us funnier, which means I should be getting my own special on Comedy Central any day now.
Lake Effect essayist Alexandra Rosas is a contributing author of the Her Stories Project, as well as other anthologies. She's also Milwaukee Grand Slam story champion for The Moth, and she lives with her family in Cedarburg. Thanks for listening to Tuesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich, hoping you'll be right back here with us tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 as we bring you another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock, and next up, it's Fresh Air, and then Here and Now comes your way at noon.